Previously, this has been a firebreak. Soon, it will be a killing ground. Portia crawls and leaps her way through seven trees and sees that the sentries are signalling first contact with the enemy. The settlement's automated defences have been triggered. All around her, the evacuation is ongoing. Those who are not dedicated fighters gathering what they can, supplies and those few possessions they cannot simply recreate, and abandoning seven trees. Some carry clutches of eggs glued to their abdomens. Many have spiderlings clinging to them. Those young that are not sensible enough to hitch a ride are likely to die. Portia swiftly draws herself up to one of the lofty watchtowers, looking out towards the tree line. Out there is an army of hundreds of thousands advancing towards seven trees. It is an independent arm of the same great ant colony her ancestress once scouted out, a centuries-old composite life form that is taking over this part of the world day by day. The nearby forest is riddled with traps. There are webs to catch incautious ants. There are spring lines, pulled taut between ground and canopy, that will stick to a passing insect, then detach and whip the luckless creature upwards to trap it in the high branches. There are deadfalls and pits, but none of them will be enough. The advancing colony will meet these dangers as it meets all dangers, by sacrificing enough of itself to nullify them, with the main thrust of its attack barely slowing. There is a particular caste of expendable scout now ranging ahead of the ant's main column, specifically to suicidally disarm these defensive measures. Now there is movement in the trees. Portia focuses on it, seeing those scouts that survive washing forwards in a chaotic mass, obeying their programming. The ground between them and seven trees is only lightly trapped, but they have other difficulties to face. The local ants are on them instantly, sallying forth valiantly to bite and sting, so that within metres of the tree line the ground becomes messy with knots of fighting insects, insensately dismembering each other and being dismembered in turn. To human eyes, the ants of the two colonies would seem indistinguishable, but Portia can discern differences in coloration and pattern, extending into the ultraviolet. She is ready with her slingshot. The arachnid defenders start their barrage with solid ammunition, simple stones gathered from the ground, chosen for their convenient size and heft. They target those scouts that break loose from the ant melee, picking them off with deadly accuracy, each shot plotted and calculated exactingly. The ants are incapable of dodging or reacting, unable to even perceive the defenders at their high vantage points. The death toll amongst the insects is ruinous. Or it would be if this host was anything but the disposable vanguard of a much greater force. Some of the scouts reach the foot of seven trees despite the bombardment. But after a metre or so of bare trunk, each tree boasts sheer web skirts that angle up and out, a surface that the ants cannot get purchase on. They climb and fall, initially mindless in their persistence. Then a sufficient concentration of messaging scent builds, and they change their tactics, climbing up over one another to form a living, reaching structure that extends blindly upwards. Portia stamps out a call to arms, and her sisters from Great Nest muster around her. The local defenders are less well armed, lacking both experience and innate understanding of ant war. She and her fellows will lead the charge. They drop swiftly from the heights onto the ant scouts and begin their work. They are far larger than the attackers, both stronger and swifter. Their bite is venomous, but it is a venom best used against spiders, so they now concentrate on using their fangs at the intersection of the insects' bodies, between head and thorax, between thorax and abdomen. Most of all, they are more intelligent than their enemies, better able to react and manoeuvre and evade. They tear apart the scouts and their bridge building with furious haste, always moving, never letting the ants latch onto them. Portia leaps back to the trunk, then scuttles over to cling effortlessly to the same silk underhang that the ants could not climb. Upside down, she sees fresh movement at the tree line. The main column has arrived. These new ants are larger, though still smaller than herself. They are of many castes, each to its own speciality. At the head of the column, and already accelerating along the scout's scent trail towards seven trees, come the shock troopers. Their formidable mandibles sport barbed, saw-edged metal blades, and they have head shields that spread back to protect their thoraxes. Their purpose is to monopolize the defender's attention and sell their lives as dearly as possible so as to allow more dangerous castes to close the distance. More of the enemy are even now entering the tunnels of the local ant's nest, spreading confounding chemicals that throw the defending insect into confusion, or even enlist them to the cause of the attacker. This is one way that the mega colony grows, by co-opting rather than destroying other ant hives. For foreign species such as Portia, though, there is no purpose and no mercy. Back in Seven Trees, the remaining local males are hard at work. Some have fled, but most of the evacuees are female. Males are replaceable, always underfoot, always too numerous. Many have been instructed to remain in the city until the last, on pain of death. Some have fled anyway, to take their chances, but there are still plenty to cut any remaining lines between the settlement and the ground, to deny the ants easy access. Others are hurrying from the reservoir, with silk parcels bulging with water. Portia notes such industry with approval. The front ranks of the column are nearing. The armoured ants suffer less from the slingshots, but now other ammunition is brought into play. Portia's people are chemists of a sort. Living in a world where scent is so vital, a small part of their language but a very large part of the way the rest of the world perceives itself, they have developed numerous inherited understandings with respect to the mixing and compounding of chemical substances, most especially pheromones. Now the slingers are sending over silk-wrapped globules of liquid to splash amongst the advancing ants. The scents thus released briefly cover up the attacker's own constant scent language, denying them not only speech, but thought and identity. Until the chemicals dissipate, the affected sections of the attacking army are deprogrammed, falling back on base instincts and unable to react properly to the situation around them. They blunder and break formation, and some of them fight each other, unable to recognise their own kin. Portia and the other defenders attack swiftly, killing as many as they can while this confusion persists. The defenders are taking losses now. Those metal jaws can sever legs or tear open bodies. Portia's warriors wear coats of silk and plates of soft wood to snare the saw teeth, shedding this armour as they need to, repairing it when they can. The column is still advancing, despite everything the defenders can do. The males are splashing water about the lower reaches of Seven Trees, proactive firefighting, for the ant colony is now deploying its real weapons. Near to Portia, there is a flash and gout of flame, and two of her comrades are instantly ablaze, like staggering torches kicking and shriveling and dying. These new ants brew chemicals inside their abdomens, just like certain species of beetle. When they jut their stingers forwards and mix these substances, there is a fierce exothermic reaction, a spray of heated fluid. The atmosphere of Portia's world has an oxygen content a few percent higher than Earth's, enough for the searing mixture to spontaneously ignite. The technology of Portia's kind is built on silk and wood, potential energy stored in tensioned lines and primitive springs. What little metal they use is stolen from the ants. They have no use for fire. Portia gains height and reverts to her sling. The flamethrower ants are lethal at short range but vulnerable to her missile fire. However, the ants now control all the ground around Seven Trees, and they are bringing forward more far-reaching weapons. She sees the first projectile as it is launched, her eyes tracking the motion automatically. A gleaming sphere of a hard, transparent, fragile material. For the ants have stumbled upon glass in the intervening generations. Now arcs overhead and shatters behind her. Her lateral eyes catch the flare as the chemicals within it mix and then explode. Below, behind the shielded shock troopers, the artillery is at work. Ants with heads encased in a metal mask that includes a back-facing tongue, a length of springy metal that their mouthparts can depress and then release, flicking their incendiary grenades some distance. Their aim is poor, blindly following the scent clues of their comrades, but there are many of them. Although the males of Seven Trees are rushing with water to douse the flames, the fires spread swiftly, shriveling silk and blackening wood. Seven Trees starts to burn. It is the end. The defenders who can do so must leave, or roast. For those that leap blindly, though, the metal jaws of the ants await. Portia scales higher and higher, racing against the flames. The upper reaches of the settlement are cluttered with desperately reaching bodies, warriors, civilians, females, males. Some shudder and drop as the smoke overcomes them. Others cannot outstrip the hungry fire. She fights her way to the top, jettisoning the wooden plates of her armour while spinning frantically. Always it has been thus. and at least she has one use for the inferno that is stoking itself below her. The thermals will give her height, so that she can use her self-made parachute to glide beyond the reach of the rapacious ant colony. For now. Only for now. This army is closing on Great Nest. And after that, there will only be the ocean. If Portia's kind cannot defeat the mindless march of the ants, then nobody will be around to write the histories of future generations. Chapter 3.3. Rock and a Hard Place. There was an awkward silence for some time after Scholes left. The unnamed gunman and the woman, Nessel, went about their duties without speaking to one another. She bent over the computer displays, he scowling at the prisoners. Having confirmed, to his own satisfaction, that furtive squirming resulted only in the restraints cutting deeper into his wrists, Holston became more and more oppressed by the silence. Yes, there was a gun pointing his way. Yes, the Gilgamesh was obviously playing host to a conflict that could plainly get him killed at any moment. But he was bored. Just out of suspension, freshly woken from decades of involuntary hibernation, and his body wanted to do something. He found he had to bite his tongue to stop himself speaking his thoughts aloud just to vary the tedium. Then someone varied it for him. There were some distant bangs that he identified after the fact as gunshots, and someone passed by the hatch with some muttered instruction he missed hearing. The gunman caught it, though, and was out on the instant, running off down the corridor and taking his gun with him. The small room seemed remarkably more spacious without it. He glanced at Lane, but she stared at her feet, avoiding his gaze. The only other person there was Nessel. "Hey," he tried. "Shut up," Lane hissed at him, but still looking away. "Hey," Holston repeated. "Nessel, is it? Listen." He thought she would just ignore him, but she glanced over sullenly. "Brenjit Nessel," she informed him. "And you're Dr. Holston Mason. I remember reading your papers back when..." "Back when?"
"Back when," Holston agreed weakly. "Well, that's, flattering, I suppose. Scholes was right then. You're a classicist yourself."
"Student," she told him. "I didn't follow it up. Who knows? If I had, maybe we'd be in each other's places right now." Her voice sounded ragged with emotion and fatigue. "Just a student." He remembered his last classes. Back before the end. The study of the old empire had once been the lifeblood of the world. Everyone had been desperate to cut a slice off the secrets of the ancients. In Holston's time, it had fallen out of favour. They had seen the end coming by then, and known that there would not be enough broken potsherds of lore from the old days to stave it off. Known that it was those same ancients, with their weapons and their waste, that had brought that long-delayed end upon them. To study and lord those antique psychopaths during the Earth's last toxic days had seemed bad taste. Nobody liked a classicist. Nessel had turned away, and so he spoke her name again, urgently. "Look, what's going to happen to us? Can you tell us that, at least?" The woman's eyes flicked towards Lane with obvious distaste. They looked kinder when they returned to Holston.
"It's like Scholes says. It's not up to us. Maybe Guion will end up storming this place and you'll get shot. Maybe they'll break through our firewalls and cut off the air or the heat or something. Or maybe we win. If we win, you get to go free. You do, anyway."
Another sidelong glance at Lane, who now had her eyes closed, either resigned to her situation or trying to unmake it all, to just blot out her surroundings.
"Look," Holston tried, "I understand you're fighting Guion. Maybe I'm even sympathetic about that. But she and I, we're not responsible. We're not a part of this. I mean, nobody consults me about these things, do they? I didn't even know this thing was, that any of this was going on until you slapped me awake back there."
"You, maybe," Nessel said, abruptly angry.
"Her, she knew.
Who'd the commander have overseeing the technical details then?
Who was arranging to ship us down there? Who had her fingers in every little piece of the work? Only the chief engineer. If we shot her right now, it'd be justice."
Holston swallowed. Lane continued to be no help, but maybe he could now see why.
"Look," he said again, more gently. "Surely you must see that this is crazy."
"Do you know what I think is crazy?" Nessel returned hotly. is setting up some fucking icebox of a base on a moon we've no use for, just so Guyan can run a flag up his dick and say he's claimed this system for Earth. What I think is crazy is expecting us to go there peaceably, willingly, and just live there in that artificial hell, while the rest of you just fuck off on some wonder trip that'll take you how many human lifetimes to get there in return? If you ever do.
We're all a lot of human lifetimes from home, Holston reminded her.
But we slept, Nessel shouted at him. And we were all together, all the human race together, and so it didn't count and it didn't matter. We brought our own time with us, and we stopped the clock while we slept and started it when we woke. Why should we care how many thousands of years went by on dead old Earth? But when the Gill heads off for wherever the fuck it's going, us poor bastards won't get to sleep. We're supposed to make a life down there, on the ice, inside those stupid little boxes the automatics have made. A life, Dr. Mason. A whole life inside those boxes. And what? And children? Can you imagine? Generations of ice dwellers forgetting and forgetting who we ever were, wasting away and never seeing the sun except as just another star, tending the bats and eating malt and putting out more doomed generations who could never amount to anything, while you, all you glorious star travellers, you get to sleep wrapped in your no time and wake up 200 years later as if it's just the next day. She was shouting now, almost shrieking, and he saw that she must have been awake for far too long, that he had cracked the dam, let it all pour out after his thoughtless words. And when you woke up, all of you chosen, who weren't condemned to the ice, we'd be dead. We'd be generations dead, all of us. And why? Because Guyan wants a presence on a dead moon. Guyan wants to preserve the human race, Lane said sharply. And whatever we encounter at the next terraforming project could obliterate the Gilgamesh for all we know. Guyan simply wants to spread our chances as a species. You know this. Then let him fucking stay. And you can stay too. How about that? When we win control, when we take the ship, the two of you can go keep the species going in that ice box on your own. That's what we'll do, believe me. If you live that long, that's just what we'll do with you.
Lane did her best to shrug it off, but Holston could see her jaw clench against the thought. Then Scholes came ducking back in, snagging Nessel's arm and dragging her aside for a muttered conversation in the doorway.
Lane, Holston started. I'm sorry, the woman said flatly, wrong-footing him. He was not sure what she was apologising for.
How far does this go? Holston murmured.
How many of them?
At least 2 dozen.
He could barely make out Lane's whispered words. They were supposed to be the pioneers. That was Guyan's plan. They'd go down awake to start everything off. The rest would be shipped down as freight, to be awoken as and when.
I see, that all worked out beautifully then, Holston remarked.
Again, her expected caustic response did not come. Some barbed edge seemed to have been filed off Lane since he had last seen her, all those decades before.
How many's Karst got? He pressed her.
She shrugged. In security details, about 12. There's military he could wake up. He'll do it too. He'll have an army.
Not if he's got any sense.
Holston had been pondering this. Why would they take orders from him to start with?
Well, who else is there?
Not good enough.
Have you actually thought about what we're doing, Lane?
I don't even mean this business, a jerk of the head towards Scholes, but the whole show. We don't have a culture. We don't have a hierarchy. We simply have a crew for life's sake. Guyan, who someone once considered fit to command a large spaceship, is now titular head of the human race.
It's the way it's got to be, Lane replied stubbornly.
Scholes disagrees. I reckon the army will disagree too, if Karst is stupid enough to start waking people up and putting guns in their hands. You know what's a good lesson of history? You're screwed if you can't pay the army. And we don't even have an economy. What could we give them as soon as they realise what's going on? Where is the chain of command? What authority does anyone have? And once they've got guns, and a clear indication of where they might wake up next, why should we ever expect them to go back to the chambers and sleep? The only currency we have is freedom, and it's plain that Guyan's not going to be handing that out. Oh, fuck off, historian. At last he got a rise out of her, though he wasn't looking for it by then. And although I don't want to think about what happens if Scholes wins, what happens if he loses?
When he loses.
Whatever. But what then? Holston insisted.
We end up shipping all these people down to a, what, a penal colony for life? And what happens when we return? What do we hope to find down there with that for a beginning?
There won't be any down there. Not for us.
It was Scholes again, pulling that trick of suddenly being in front of them, now squatting on his haunches, hands resting on his knees.
If the worst comes to the worst, we still have a plan B. Thanks to you there, anyway, Dr. Mason.
Right. Looking the man in the face, Holston didn't know what to make of that.
Maybe you'd like to explain?
Nothing would please me more.
Scholes smiled thinly.
We have control of a shuttle bay. If all else fails, we're getting ourselves off the gill, Dr. Mason, and you're coming with us.
Holston, still thinking slowly after the suspension, just goggled at him.
I thought the point was not to go somewhere.
Not to go to the ice, Nessel said from behind Scholes. But we know there's somewhere else in this very system. Somewhere made for us.
Oh,
Holston stared at them. You're completely mad.
There are monsters there.
Monsters can be fought,
Scholes declared implacably.
But it's not just that. There's a satellite. It came within a hair's breadth of destroying the whole of the Gilgamesh. It sent us away. There's no way a shuttle can possibly get...
He stammered to a halt, because Scholes was smiling at him.
We know all this. She told us.
A companionable nod towards Lane.
She told us we'd never make the green planet, that the ancient tech would get us first. But that's why we have you, Dr. Mason. Maybe Nessel's grasp of the ancient languages would be enough, but I'll not take that chance. Why should I, when you're right here and desperate to help us?
The chief mutineer stood up easily, still with that razor grin on his face. Holston looked at Lane, and this time she met his gaze, and he read the emotion there at last. Guilt. No wonder she'd been easy on him. She was cringing inside, knowing that she had brought him here.
You told them I could get them past Kern?
He demanded.
No, she protested. I told them it couldn't be done. I said that even with you, we barely made it. But
you managed to get them thinking of me,
Holston finished.
How was I to know these fuckwits had just...
Lane started, before Scholes stamped on her ankle.
Just a reminder, he growled, of who you are and why you deserve all you get. And don't worry, if we have to take the shuttle, you'll be right there with us, Chief Engineer Lane. Perhaps you might feel like using your expertise to prolong your own life, for once, rather than just to ruin other people's.
Chapter 3.4 By the Western Ocean. The Great Nest, the greatest metropolis of Portia's kind. Home. Returning like this, at the head of a band of defeated stragglers, those lucky enough to escape the flames of Seven Trees, Portia feels something analogous to shame. She has not stopped the enemy, or even slowed it down. Each day, the ant colony will march closer to Great Nest. Looking across the expanse of her beloved birthplace, she finds herself picturing it in the throes of evacuation. In her mind's eye, a faculty already present in some form even for her tiniest ancestress, she sees her home burning. The ants do not know where Great Nest is, of course. Their spread across the world is methodical but mindless, but they will reach the coast soon. The days are counting down to when they will arrive at the gates. Great Nest is vast, home to several thousand spiders. The natural forest is still thick here, but great effort and artifice has gone into erecting artificial trees to provide more living room. Great pillars made from felled trunks, sheathed and strengthened with silk, spread out from the living copse at the city's centre, and even out into the sea itself, allowing the webwork of the city to reach out across the waters. Space is at a premium, and over the last century, Great Nest has grown exponentially in all directions, including up. Beyond the city proper, there lies a patchwork of farms, aphids for honeydew, mice for meat, and stands of the blister-trunked trees cultivated by the ants, another secret stolen from the enemy. The seas throng with fish ready for the netting, and offshore there is a sister settlement on the seabed. Relations with the marine stomatopod culture are cordial and mutually profitable in a minimal sort of way. A generation ago there was friction as the spiders began to expand their city seawards. The sunken bases of the pillars, however, have enriched the marine environment,
providing an artificial reef that sea life has quickly taken advantage of. In retrospect, the sea dwellers concede that they have gained from this situation, however inadvertently. Portia and her band get aloft quickly, clambering up towards the city on lines strung over the outlying farmland. She has brought back some warriors, and a reasonable number of males, though few will thank her for returning with the latter. The smaller males are better able to parachute to safety. They survived when many of their sisters did not. And they fought, Portia concedes. The idea of a male warrior is absurd, but they are still stronger and faster and more intelligent than ants. For a moment, she has a mad idea. Arm and train the males, thus vastly increasing the number of fighters available to Great Nest. But she shies away from the idea instantly. That way anarchy lies, the reversal of the natural order of things. Moreover, even that way their numbers would not be enough. Arm every male in the city, and the spiders would still be only a drop against the ant colony's ocean. She reaches a high vantage point, looking down at the great elegant sweep of her home, the myriad threads that link it all together. Down in the bay she sees a great balloon of silk half submerged in the water, sagging and rippling as it is filled with air, an embassy to the stomatopods, she knows, a diving bell allowing inquiring minds amongst her people to visit their underwater counterparts. There can be no exchange of understandings with the sea dwellers, of course, but they can still teach and learn, via the simple language of gestures that the two cultures have worked out between them. "Seek out your peers," she instructs her fellows, the returning warriors. "Await the call." The males she leaves to their own devices. If they possess any initiative, they will find work and get fed. In a vast city like Great Nest, there is a constant need for maintenance, lines and sheets of silk needing repairs. An industrious male can make himself useful enough to be rewarded. The alternative for him is to make a living through courtship and flattery, which involves less effort, but considerably more danger. Portia sets off through the city, creeping and jumping from line to line, seeking out her peer house. Using communal creches, and lacking any maternal instincts, Portia's people have no strict family units. The youngest spiderlings, still confined to the creche, are provided with food by the city, but this period of free bounty does not last long. The fast-maturing young are expected to become independent within their first year. Like the males, they must make themselves useful. Because a spider alone is vulnerable, always at the mercy of bullying from her larger kin, these maturing spiderlings tend to band together into peer groups formed from those who hatched from the same creche at around the same time. The bonds made between juveniles, who aid and rely upon one another, persist into adulthood. Unions of such peers form the base social unit in most spider settlements, and these peers then tend to found a creche between them, looking after one another's eggs, and so inadvertently perpetuating a continuity of heredity down the female line. The social bonds within such peer groups are strong, even after the individuals have gone their separate ways and taken up their particular trades and specialities. All the larger peer groups maintain peer houses within the city, house here meaning a complex of silk-walled chambers. Males do not form such groups, for who would have any use for a large group of males? Instead, juvenile males do their best to attach themselves to the periphery of a female peer group, playing at flirting, running errands, paying in utility and amusement value for the scraps of food that might get thrown their way. Portia is vaguely aware that males fight each other, and that the lower, less desirable reaches of the city play host to countless little dramas between males struggling over food or status. She has very little interest in the subject. She is bitterly exhausted when she crawls through the entrance of her peer house, located at the lowest point of the series of bubble chambers in which her fellows dwell and meet. Another couple of rooms have been added since she was last here. Restructuring is no major chore for her kind, and for a moment she feels proud and happy that her peers are doing well, before her treacherous memory goads her with the thought of the ants' inexorable advance. Building more just means more to lose. Those of her peers who are currently in residence greet her warmly. Several of her closer friends are holding court there at the centre of a worshipful knot of younger females and fluttering, dancing males. Their dances are courtship rituals that they constantly, almost, but not quite, consummate. Other than menial labour, this is the place of a male in Portia's society. Adornment, decoration, simply to add value to the lives of females.
The larger, more notable, or more important a female is, the more males will dance attendance on her. Hence, having a crowd of uselessly elegant males around one is a status symbol. If Portia, the great warrior, were to stay still long enough, then she would attract her own entourage of hopeful parasites. Indeed, if she cast them off and refused their attentions, she would be diminishing herself in the eyes of her peers and her culture. And sometimes the courtship will proceed as far as mating, if the female feels sufficiently safe and prosperous to start work on a clutch of eggs. The act of courtship is consummated as a public ritual, where the hopeful males, in their moment of prominence, perform in front of a peer group, or even the whole city, before the female chooses her partner and accepts his package of sperm. She may then kill and eat him, which is thought to be a great honour for the victim, although even Portia suspects that the males do not quite see it that way. It is a mark of how far her species has come that this is the only openly acceptable time when killing a male is considered appropriate. It is, however, quite true that packs of females, especially younger ones, perhaps newly formed peer groups seeking to strengthen their bonds, will descend to the lower reaches of the city and engage in hunting males. The practice is covertly overlooked. Girls will be girls, after all, but overtly frowned upon. Killing a male, sanctioned or not, is a world apart from killing a beast. Even as the fang strikes, the killer and the slain know themselves to be part of a grander whole. The nanovirus speaks, each to each. Portia's culture is strung between base spider nature and the new empathy the nanovirus has inflicted upon them. There are more of her peers here than Portia had expected to see. One of her seniors is entering her time, and therefore must retire from society for a month or so. And her sisters are rallying round her to make the ordeal as painless as possible. Portia ascends to one of the inner chambers to witness the rite, because it will at least give the illusion that life here is proceeding according to age-old patterns, and so might continue in the same way for generations to come. She arrives just in time to see her ailing sister retreat into her cocoon. In ancient, primitive times, she would have been left alone in some high, safe spot, spinning her own retreat before retiring in lonely secrecy. Now, she has sisters to create her haven for her, and then keep her company, while she molts. Portia's kind must shed their skins in order to grow. When it is time for a large female to cast off her skin, when she feels it too tight at each joint, and with each breath of her abdomen, she retires to her peer house, to the company of those she trusts, and they spin her a cocoon that will support her expanded frame until her expanded skin has hardened again. As Portia watches, the retiring female begins the difficult, painful task of ridding herself of her skin, first flexing her abdomen until the shell cracks there, and then peeling herself from back to front. The process will take hours, and her sisters stroke the cocoon with messages of solidarity and support. They have all been through this. It must be difficult for males, who presumably undergo the ordeal alone, but then males are smaller and less sensitive, and Portia is honestly not sure how capable they are of finer levels of thought and feeling. A handful of her sisters notice Portia there and scurry over to talk. They listen with agitation to her news of seven trees, news that will be all over Great Nest by now, because males can never keep their feet still when they have something to say. Her fellows touch palps and try to tell her that what happened to seven trees cannot happen here. But nothing they say can remove those images from Portia's memory. The flames, the whole structure of a thriving settlement just withering in the heat. The reservoir fraying and splitting, its waters cascading down amid a rising current of steam. Those who could not jump or glide far enough being overwhelmed by the roiling tide of ants to be dismembered while still alive. She performs a careful calculation based on her count of days and the elevation of the sun outside, and tells them that she is going to the temple. She badly needs peace of mind, and the messenger will be passing soon. "Go quickly. There will be many others seeking the same," one of her sisters advises her. Even without Portia's personal experience, the population of Great Nest is fast becoming aware that they face a threat seemingly without limit. All their centuries of culture and sophistication may become nothing but a fading memory in the minds of the stomatopod sea dwellers. The temple at Great Nest is the city's highest point, a space without walls, strung between the extremity of the canopy above with an inward-sloping floor below. At its centre, on the apex of one of the city's original trees, is the crystal
that Portia's own ancestress wrested from the ants, a deed that has since become legend. If Portia reaches inside herself, she can even touch that other Portia's understandings, a private retelling of the well-known story through the lens of first-hand experience. She arrives ahead of the messenger's appearance, but there is already barely room for her amongst the crouching multitude, thronged all the way up to the central trunk. Many have the look of refugees, those who escaped Seven Trees and other places. They are come here to find hope, because the material world outside seems to hold little of it. How Portia's people regard the messenger and its message is hard to say. Theirs is an alien mindset, trying to unravel the threads of a phenomenon they are equipped to analyse and yet not understand. They gaze up at the messenger in its fleet passage across the sky, and they see an entity that speaks to them in mathematical riddles that are aesthetically appealing to a species that has inherited geometry as the cornerstone of its civilization. They do not conceive of it as some celestial spider god that will reach down into their green world and save them from the ant tide. However, the message is. The messenger is. These are facts, and those facts are the doorway to an invisible, intangible world of the unknown. The true meaning of the message is that there is more than spider eyes can see or spider feet can feel. That is where hope lies, for there may yet be salvation hidden within that more. It inspires them to keep looking. The priestess has emerged to dance, her stylus hunting out the connection points on the crystal, as invisibly the messenger crosses the blue vault of the sky while broadcasting its constant message. Portia spins and knots, reciting the mantras of numbers to herself, watching the votary begin her elegant visual proofs, each step and every sweep of her palps speaking of the beauty of universal order, the reassurance that there is a logic to the world, extending beyond the mere chaos of the physical. But even here, there is a sense of change and threat. As Portia watches the dance, it seems to her that the priestess halts sometimes, just for a second, or even stumbles. Ripples of unease pass through the close-packed congregation, who spin all the harder, as if to cover over that slip. An inexperienced priestess, Portia reassures herself, but she feels dreadfully afraid deep within herself. Is the doom that threatens her people in the material world now being reflected in the heavens? Is there a variation in the eternal message? After the service finishes, and feeling more shaken than reassured, she finds a male in her way, frantically signalling his good intentions and that he bears a message for her. You are needed, the little creature tells her, coming close enough to brave her fangs in his insistence. Bianca asks for you. Bianca, this particular Bianca, is one of Portia's peer group, but not one that she has spoken with in a long time. No warrior, but instead one of the foremost scholars of Portia's people. Lead me, Portia directs. Chapter 3.5 Bearing a Flaming Sword. Holston and Lane had been left to their own limited devices for some time, constantly overseen by one or other of Scholes's people. Holston had been hoping to have more words with Nessel, on the basis that he might just be able to trade enough on his doctorate to gain some sort of cooperation from her, but she had been redeployed by her leader, perhaps for that exact reason. Instead, there had been a succession of taciturn men and women with guns, one of whom had bloodied Holston's lip just for opening his mouth. They had heard distant shots on occasion, but the anticipated crescendo never seemed to arrive, nor did the fighting recede entirely out of earshot. It seemed that neither Scholes nor Cast was willing to force the matter to any sort of conclusion.
"It's times like these," Holston started, speaking softly for Lane's benefit only. She raised an eyebrow.
"Times like what, Mason? Being held hostage by lunatic mutineers who might kill us at any second? How many times like those have you had exactly? Or is the world of academia more interesting than I thought?" He shrugged.
"Well, on the basis that we were all under a death sentence on Earth, and then the last time we were working together, a mad computer person hybrid thing wanted to kill us for disturbing its monkeys, I think it's been times like these all the way, to be honest."
Her smile was faint, but it was there. "I'm sorry I got you into this."
"Not half as sorry as I am."
At that point, Scholes burst in with a half-dozen followers crowding the hatch behind him. He shoved something into the hands of the guard that the man quickly donned. A mask,
They were all putting on oxygen masks.
Oh, fuck, Lane spat. Kars got control of the air vents.
From her tone, it was something that she had been anticipating for some time.
Cut him loose!
From behind the mask, Skulls' voice emerged with the tinny precision of his radio transmitter. Immediately, someone was bending over Holston, severing his restraints, hauling him to his feet.
He's coming with us,
Skulls snapped. And now Holston could hear gunfire again, and more of it than before.
What about her?
A nod towards Lane.
Shoot the bitch. Wait! Hold on!
Holston got out, flinching as the gun swung back towards him.
You need me?
Then you need her. She's the chief engineer, for life's sake. If you're going anywhere on a shuttle, if you're serious about going up against Kern, against that killer satellite, then you need her. Come on, she's key crew. That means she's the best engineer on the ship.
And,
despite his words when the gun swung back towards Lane,
no, seriously, wait, I know you can force me to do whatever you want. But if you kill her, I'll fucking fight you to my last breath. I'll sabotage the shuttle. I don't know what I'll do, but I'll find something. Keep her alive, and I'll do everything you need, and everything I can think of, to keep you alive. To keep us all alive. Come on, it makes sense. Surely you can see it makes sense.
He could not see Skulls' expression, and for a moment the chief mutineer just stood there, statue still, but then he nodded once, and exceedingly grudgingly.
Get them both masks, he snapped.
Get them up, resecure their arms and bring them along. We're getting off this ship right now. Outside in the corridor waited a dozen or so of Skulls' people, most of them also wearing masks. Holston looked from one set of visor-framed eyes to the next until he picked out Nessel, not quite a familiar face, but better than nothing at all. The rest of them, men and women both, were strangers.
Shuttle bay, now!
Was Skulls' order, and then they set off, shoving Lane and Holston ahead of them. Holston had no idea about much of the Gilgamesh's layout, but Skulls and his party seemed to be taking a decidedly circuitous route to wherever they were going. The chief mutineer was constantly muttering, obviously in radio contact with his subordinates. Presumably there was some serious offensive by security going on, and certainly the pace quickened and quickened again. First to the shuttle bay wins? Then one of the mutineers stumbled and fell, leaving Holston wondering if he'd missed the sound of a shot. Nessel dropped to one knee beside him and began fiddling with his mask, and a moment later the man was stirring drunkenly, staggering to his feet with Skulls roundly cursing him.
Since when did we have poison gas on the ship?
The classicist demanded wildly. Again, the whole episode was assuming a dreamlike quality. Lane's voice sounded right in his ear.
Idiot.
Just fucking with the air mix would do it. I guess these monkeys have been fighting for control of the air conditioning since they made their stupid stand, and now they've lost. This is a spaceship, remember? The atmosphere is whatever the machines say it should be.
All right, Holston managed to reply, as someone shoved him hard in the back to get him to pick up speed.
What? The man beside him demanded, shooting him a suspicious look. Holston realized that Lane's voice had not broadcast to the rest of them, only to him. I despair of you, old man, came her murmur. These masks do have tongue controls, you realize. Of course you don't. And neither do these clowns. You have four tabs by your tongue. Second one selects comms menu, then third for private channel. Select 9. It'll show in your display. It took him the best part of 10 minutes to get through that, slobbering over the controls and terrified that one false drool would turn his air supply off. In the end, it was only when their escorts halted abruptly for a furious discussion that he was able to work it out.
How's this?
Clear enough, came Lane's dry response. So, how fucked are we, eh?
Was that seriously what you wanted to say?
Look, Mason, they hate my guts. What I really want to say is that you should talk them into letting you go. Tell them you're a crap hostage or that they don't need you or something. He blinked, seeking out her eyes but finding only the lamps reflecting in the plastic of her visor.
And you?
I am more fucked than you by an entire order of magnitude, old man.
They're all in big trouble, he came back. Nobody's getting onto that planet.
Who knows? I wasn't exactly planning anything like this, but I have been thinking around the problem.
Get moving!
Skulls suddenly snapped. Then people were shooting at them from ahead. Holston had a glimpse of a pair of figures in some sort of armoured suit, dark plastic plates over shiny grey fabric, presumably the full security detail uniform. They were lumbering forwards, holding rifles awkwardly, and Skulls hauled Lane in front of him.
Back! Or she goes first!
He yelled.
This is your one and only chance to give yourselves up!
came what might have been Karst's voice from one of the suits.
"Guns down, you turds!"
One of the mutineers shot at him, and then they were all at it. Holston saw both figures stagger. One was knocked flat over onto its back. It was only the frustrated momentum of the bullets, though. There was no sign of penetration, and the fallen security man was already sitting up again, levelling his gun.
"Face plates! Aim for the face!"
Scholes shouted.
"Still bulletproof, you moron," Lane's taut voice in Holston's ear.
"Wait!" the classicist yelled. "Hold it! Hold it!" And Lane convulsed in Scholes's grip with a howl that was abominably loud in Holston's ear.
"Oh, you twat! I'm half deaf!" she snapped.
The man next to Holston grabbed at his arm to try and rope him in as a second human shield, and the classicist pulled away instinctively. A moment later, the mutineer was on the ground, three dark patches spread across his ship suit. It was too quick for Holston to feel any reaction. Another mutineer, a woman, had managed to close with security, and Holston saw a knife flash out. He was in the middle of thinking what a feeble threat that must be when she got the blade into one of them and ripped a gash down the man's arm, the grey material parting stubbornly, armour plate peeling back. The injured security man flailed, and his companion, Karst, turned and shot at her, bullets scattering and ricocheting from his companion's armour.
"Go!"
Scholes was already moving on, hauling Lane behind him.
"Get a door closed between us and them. Get us time. Have that shuttle warmed up and ready."
The last words presumably directed to some other follower already sitting in the bay. Shots followed them, and at least one other mutineer simply dropped, sprawling as they fled. But then Nessel had a heavy door sliding down behind them, hunching over the controls, presumably to try and jam them in some jury-rigged way to delay security that little bit more. Scholes left her to it, but she caught up with the main pack soon after, showing a surprising turn of speed.
"No waiting for stragglers once we're at the shuttle, then."
Holston was seeing his opportunity to make a stand diminishing. He lunged at the mask tongue controls until he was on general broadcast again.
"Listen to me, Scholes. All of you," he started.
One of the mutineers cuffed him across the head, but he bore it.
"I know you think there's some chance if you can get off the ship and head for the terraform project. Probably you've seen the pictures of that spider thing that lives there. And yes, you've got guns. You'll have all the tech from the shuttle. Spiders, no problem, sure. Seriously, though, that satellite will not listen to anything we've got to say. You think we'd be anywhere but that damn planet otherwise? It was within a hair of carving up the whole Gilgamesh, and it blew up a whole load of spy drones that tried to get near. Now, your shuttle's way smaller than the Gil, and it's way clumsier than drones. And I swear, I do not have anything I can say that will work on the insane whatever that's in that satellite."
"Then think of something," was Scholes's cold response.
"I am telling you,"
Holston began, and then they spilled out into the shuttle bay. It was smaller than he had thought, just a single craft there, and he realized he knew nothing about this side of the ship's operations. Was this some special yacht for the commander to gad about in? Or were all the shuttles in their own separate bays? Or what? It was an utter blank to him, not his area, nothing he had needed to know.
"Please listen," he tried. "They made the mistake of showing us what our new home was going to be like,"
called Nessel's voice.
"I swear the commander never imagined that anyone might defy his almighty wisdom. You can say what you like, Dr. Mason, but you didn't see it. You didn't see what it was like."
"We'll take our chances with the spiders and the AI," Scholes agreed.
"It's not an AI."
But he was already being bundled into the shuttle, with Lane right alongside him. He could hear more shooting, but certainly not close enough to change things now.
"Get the bay doors open. Override the safeties,"
Scholes ordered.
"If they're after us, let's see if those suits of theirs can handle vacuum."
And even as Lane was muttering, "They can," for Holston's ears only, he felt the shuttle's reactor begin to shift them forwards. He was about to leave the Gilgamesh for the first time in 2,000 years. The shuttle cabin was cramped. Half the mutineers had decamped to the hold, where Holston hoped there were belts and straps to secure them. Acceleration was currently telling every loose object, or person, that down was the rear of the ship, and when they reached whatever speed fuel economy dictated was their safe maximum, there would be no effective down at all. Holston and Lane occupied the rearmost two seats of the cabin, where people could keep an eye on them. Scholes himself had the seat next to the pilot, with Nessel and two others sitting beside him at the consoles. Holston's gut lurched under the pressure of the acceleration as they made their getaway. For a moment he thought he was about to lose his stomach contents through the hatch into the hold behind him, but the feeling passed. His bloodstream was still swimming with suspension chamber drugs that fought hard to stabilize his sudden feelings of instability. The first thing Lane said to him once the shuttle got clear was, "Keep the mask. We need a secure channel." Her tightly controlled tones came through the receiver beside Holston's ear. Sure enough, the mutineers were removing their breathing masks. Now they were in an environment they had full control of. One of them reached back for Lane's, and she bucked her head upwards sharply as he grabbed it, so that she ended up wearing the thing as a sort of high-tech bandana covering her mouth. Holston tried the same trick, but just ended up in an awkward pulling match with the man, without achieving anything.
"Sod you, then," he was told. "Suffocate if you like."
Then the mutineer turned away. Lane leant over quickly, teeth digging into the rubber seal so she could yank his mask down like hers. For a moment she was cheek to cheek with him, eye to eye, and he had a weird feeling of horribly inappropriate intimacy, as though she might kiss him. Then she regained her balance, and the two of them sat there with masks in identical, awkward positions, Holston thinking, how much more like conspirators could we look? The mutineers had other priorities, though. One of the men sat at a console, apparently fighting the Gilgamesh's attempts to override control of the shuttle, whilst Nessel and another woman were giving reports on the systems powering up. After listening a while, Holston realized that they were waiting to see if the Ark ship had any weapons it could bring to bear. They don't even know. Are they wondering if Lane and I will save them by being here? Because if so, they weren't listening to Guyan closely enough before. At last, Lane piped up for all to hear, although her voice echoed hollowly over Holston's mask speaker as well.
"The Gilgamesh only has its anti-asteroid array, and that's forwards-facing. Unless you decide to moon the front cameras, there's nothing able to come your way."
They regarded her distrustfully, but Nessel's reports seemed to confirm the same.
"What would happen if an asteroid was going to hit us in the side?" Holston asked.
Lane gave him a look that said eloquently,
"And that's what's important right now?"
"The odds are vanishingly unlikely. It wasn't resource effective."
"To protect the entire human race?"
Nessel demanded, more as a jab at Lane than anything else.
"The Gill was designed by engineers, not philosophers,"
Issa Lane shrugged, or as much as she could with her hands still secured.
"Let me free. I need to work." "You stay right there," Scholes told her. "We're clear now. It's not like they can just turn the Gill around and come after us. We'd be halfway across the system before they could build up any speed."
"And how far is this tin box going to get you exactly?" Lane challenged him.
"What supplies do you have? How much fuel?"
"Enough. And we always knew this was a one-way trip," the chief mutineer said grimly.
"You won't even get one way," Lane told him.
Immediately, Scholes had his seatbelt undone and fell the short distance towards them, gripping hand over hand along the seatbacks. The movement was fish-like, effortless enough that the man had plainly put in some training time back home.
"If the Gill isn't shooting, I'm feeling less and less certain why we need you," he remarked.
"Because it's not the ship you need to worry about. That satellite out there is a killer. It's got a defense laser that will just carve this boat into tiny pieces. The Gilgamesh's array is nothing to that."
"That's why we have the esteemed Dr. Mason," Scholes told her, hovering over her like a cloud.
"You need to let me loose on your systems. You need to give me full access and let me rip the fuck out of your comms panel."
Lane smiled brightly.
"Or we're all dead anyway. Even if it doesn't shoot. Mason, you tell him. Tell him about how Dr. Avrana Kern said hello."
Their acceleration was levelling out, weightlessness replacing the heavy hand that had been pressing Holston back into his seat. After a blank moment, then catching Lane's eye, the classicist nodded animatedly.
"It took over our systems completely. We had absolutely no control. It went through the Gilgamesh's computers in seconds, locked us out. It could have opened all the airlocks, poisoned the air, purged all the suspension chambers."
His voice trailed off. At the time, he had not quite appreciated just what might have happened.
"Who is Dr. Avrana Kern?"
one of the mutineers asked. Holston exchanged looks with Lane.
"She is what's in the satellite. She's one of the things in the satellite, rather. There are the basic computers, and then there's something called Eliza, which maybe it's an AI, a proper AI, or maybe it's just a very well-made computer. And then there's Dr. Avrana Kern, who might also be an AI."
"Or might be what?"
Nessel prompted him.
"Or
might just be a stark raving mad psychotic human being left over from the old empire who's taken it into her head that keeping us off the planet is the single most important objective in the universe, he managed, looking from face to face. Fuck, said someone, almost reverently. Evidently something in Holston's testimony had sounded convincing. Or maybe she'll be having a good day, and she'll just take over the shuttle systems and fly you back to the Gilgamesh, Lane suggested sweetly. Ah, on that subject, the pilot broke in, it looks like our damage to the drone bays has paid off. There's no sign of a remote launch, but wait, Gil is launching a shuttle after us. Skulls spun himself around and coasted over to see for himself. Guyan is really pissed, came Lane's voice sotto voce in Holston's ear. He's crazy, the classicist replied. She regarded him impassively, and for a moment he thought she was going to defend the man, but then, yeah. No, he's crazy, all right. Perhaps it's the sort of crazy you need to have got us all the way out here, but it's starting to go off the bad end of the scale. They're telling us to cut engines, surrender our weapons, and give up the prisoners, the pilot relayed. What makes them think we'd do that, now that we're winning? Skulls stated. The look that passed between Lane and Holston was in complete accord that here, in spirit, was Vree Guyan's very double. Then Skulls was hovering above them again, staring down. You know that we'll kill you if you try anything, he told Lane. I'm trying to keep track of all the ways this venture is likely to kill me, but yes, that's one of them. She looked up at him without flinching. Seriously, I'm more concerned about that satellite. You need to cut us free right now. You need me isolating the ship's systems so that thing can't just walk in and take over. Why not just cut the comms altogether? One of the mutineers asked. Good luck on getting Mason to sweet-talk the satellite if we can't transmit and receive, she pointed out acidly. Feel free to have someone looking over my shoulder at all times. I'll even talk them through what I'm doing. If we lose power or control for one moment, if I think you're trying to slow us so the other shuttle can catch up with us, Skulls started. I know, I know. With a scowl, the chief mutineer produced a knife and severed Lane's bonds, and Holston's too, as an afterthought. You sit there, he told the classicist. Nothing for you to do yet. Once she's done her work, you'll get your chance with the satellite. Apparently he didn't feel that making overt death threats was necessary to keep Holston in line. Lane, clumsy in the lack of gravity, flailed over to the comms console and belted herself down in the seat next to Nessel. Right, what we're after here, she started, and then the language between them got sufficiently technical that Holston failed to follow. It was obvious that the work would take some time, though, both reprogramming and physically cutting connections between comms and the rest of the shuttle's systems. Holston gradually fell asleep. Even as he was dropping off, he felt this was a ridiculous thing to do, considering the constant threat to life and limb, combined with the fact that he had been out of the world for a century or so not so long ago. Suspension and sleep were not quite the same, however, and as the adrenaline now ebbed from his system, it left him feeling hollowed out and bone-weary. A hand on his shoulder woke him up. For a moment, stirred from dreams he could barely recall, he spoke a name from the old world, one a decade dead, even before he embarked on the Gilgamesh. Millennia dead now. Then, Lane? Because he heard a woman's voice. But instead it was Nessel, the mutineer. Dr. Mason, she said, with that curious respect she seemed to hold for him. They're ready for you. He undid his seatbelt and allowed them to pass him unceremoniously hand over hand across the ceiling, until Lane could reach out and snag him and drag him into the comms chair. How far out are we? He asked her. It's taken me longer than I'd thought to make sure I cut every single connection to comms. And because our friends here don't trust me and kept getting me to stop in case I was doing something nefarious. We've shielded all the shuttle systems from any outside transmission, though. Nothing is accepting any connection that isn't hardwired into the ship itself, except the comms. And the comms don't interact with the rest of what we've got in here. The most Dr. Avarana Kern can manage now is to take over the comms panel and shout at us. And destroy us with her lasers, Holston pointed out. Yeah, well, and that. But you better get on with telling her not to right now because the sats started signalling. Holston felt a shudder go through him. Show me. It was a familiar message, identifying the satellite as the second Bryn sentry habitat and instructing them to avoid the planet. Just what they'd got when they interrupted the distress beacon the first time. But that time, we'd signalled it. And it hadn't noticed us inbound. This time,
We're in a much smaller ship, and it's taking the initiative. Something's still awake over there. He remembered the electronic spectre of Avrana Kern appearing on the screens of the Gilgamesh comms room, her voice translated into their native tongue, a facility with language that neither he nor Lane had felt the need to comment on to the mutineers. Instead, though, he decided to keep matters formal just for now. He readied a message. "May I speak to Eliza?" Translated it into Imperial C and sent it, counting the shortening minutes until a response could be expected. "Let's see who's home," Lane murmured in his ear, peering over his shoulder. The response came back to him, and it was disturbing and reassuring in equal measures. The latter because at least the situation on the satellite was as he remembered. "You are currently on a heading that will bring you to a quarantine planet, and no interference with this planet will be countenanced. Any interference with Kern's world will be met with immediate retaliation. You are not to make contact with this planet in any way."
"Monkeys! The monkeys are back! They want to take away my world! It's only for me! And my monkeys are not, as they say, as they seem, as much as they claim to be from Earth! I know better! Vermin! They are vermin! Leaving the sinking ship of Earth has sunk, and no word, no word, none!"
The translation came easily. Nessel, poised at his other shoulder, made a baffled noise. "Eliza, we will not interfere with Kern's world. We are a scientific mission come to observe the progress of your experiment. Please confirm permission to land." Holston thought it was worth a try. Waiting for the reply was just as wearing on the nerves as he remembered. "Any idea when we'll be in range of its lasers?" he asked Lane. "Based on Kost's drones, I think we have 4 hours, 19 minutes. Make them count. Permission to approach the planet is denied. Any attempt to do so will be met with lethal force as per scientific devolved powers. Isolation of experimental habitat is paramount. You are respectfully requested to alter your course effective immediately."
"Filthy, crawling vermin coming to infect my monkeys will not talk to me. It has been so long, so long. Eliza, why will they not speak? Why will they not call to me? My monkeys are silent, so silent, and all I have to talk to is you, and all you are is my broken reflection."
"Eliza, I would like to speak to your sister Avrana," Holston sent immediately, aware of time falling away, their limited stock of seconds dropping through the glass.
"Brace yourselves," Lane warned. "If we didn't get this right, we might be about to lose everything, possibly including life support."
The voice that spoke through the comms panel, without anyone giving it permission, was sticking to Imperial C at that moment, though to Holston its haughty tones were unmistakable. The content was little more than a more aggressive demand that they alter their course. "Dr. Kern," Holston sent, "we are here to observe your great experiment. We will not alter anything on the planet. But surely some manner of observation is permitted. Your experiment has been running for a very long period of time. Surely it should have come to fruition by now. Can we assist you? Perhaps, if we gather data, you may be able to put it to use." In truth, he had no certain idea what Kern's experiment was, though by now he had formed some theories, and he was simply bouncing off what he had gleaned from Kern's own stream of consciousness thoughts, transmitted along with Eliza's sober words.
"You lie," came the reply, and his heart sank. "Do you think I cannot hear the traffic in this system? You are fugitives, criminals, vermin amongst vermin. Already the vessel pursuing you has asked me to disable your craft so that they may bring you to justice."
Holston stared at the words, his mind working furiously. For a moment there he had been negotiating with Kern in good faith, as though he was actually a mutineer himself. He had almost forgotten his status as hostage. His hands hovered, ready to send the next signal. "Why don't you do just that?" Something cold pressed into his ear. His eyes flicked sideways to catch Nessel's hard expression. "Don't even think it," she told him. "Because if this ship gets stopped, you and the engineer won't live to get rescued."
"Shoot a gun in here and you're likely to punch a hole straight through the hull," Lane said tightly.
"Then don't give us an excuse." Nessel nodded at the console. "You might be the expert, Dr. Mason, but don't think I'm not catching most of this."
"Typical that now I find an able student," Holston thought despairingly. "So what do you want me to say?" he demanded. "You heard what I heard then, that she knows what we are. She's receiving all the transmissions from the Gilgamesh and the other shuttle."
"Tell her about the moon colony," Skoll snapped.
tell her what they wanted us to do.
Whatever we're talking to now has been in a satellite smaller than this shuttle since the end of the old empire.
You're looking for sympathy? Lane demanded.
Dr. Kern, we are human beings, like you, Holston sent, wondering how true that latter part could possibly be. You could have destroyed the Gilgamesh, and you did not. I understand how important your experiment is to you, another lie, but please, we are human beings. I am a hostage on this vessel. I am a scholar, like you. If you do as you say, they will kill me.
The words passed into cold, dead Imperial Sea, like a treatise, as though Holston Mason was already a figure long consigned to history, to be debated over by academics of a latter age. The gaps between message and response were ever shorter as they closed with the planet.
You are currently on a heading that will bring you to a quarantine planet, and no interference with this planet will be countenanced. Any interference with Kern's world will be met with immediate retaliation. You are not to make contact with this planet in any way.
They are not my responsibility. So heavy. A whole planet is mine. They must not interfere with the experiment, must proceed. Or what was it all for? Nothing if the monkeys do not speak to me, and my monkeys are all that's left of the human now. These vermin come. These vermin.
No, Holston shouted. Not back to Eliza!
Startling the mutineers.
What's going on? Scholes demanded. Nessel?
We've dropped back a step or something?
Holston sat back numbly, his mind quite blank. Suddenly, Scholes was speaking in his ear.
Is that it, then? You're out of ideas?
In tones crammed with dangerous subtext.
Wait!
Holston said, but for a perilous moment his mind remained completely empty. He had nothing. Then he had something.
Lane, do we have the drone footage?
Ah.
Lane scrabbled and clawed her way over to another console, fighting for space with the mutineer already seated there.
Cast's recording?
Yes, I have it. Get it onto the comms panel.
Are you sure?
Only, please, Lane. Circumventing the comms isolation without opening the ship up to contamination was a surprisingly complex process. But Lane and one of the mutineers set up a second isolated drop box with the data and then patched it into the comms system. Holston imagined the invisible influence of Dr. Kern flooding down the new connection, only to find just another dead end.
Dr. Avrana Kern, he readied his next message. I think you should reconsider the need of your experimental world for an observer. When our ship passed your world last, a remote camera captured some images from down there. I think you need to see this. It was a gamble, a terrible game to play with whatever deranged fragments of Kern still inhabited the satellite, but there was a gun to his head. And besides, he could not deny a certain measure of academic curiosity. How will you react? He sent the message and the file, guessing that Kern's recent exposure to the Gilgamesh's systems would allow her to decode the data. Bare minutes later, there was an incomprehensible transmission from the satellite, very little more than white noise. And then,
please hold for further instructions. Please hold for further instructions.
What have you done with my monkeys? What have you done with my monkeys?
And then nothing. A complete cessation of transmission from the satellite, leaving those in the shuttle to fiercely debate what Holston had done and what he might have achieved.
Chapter 3.6 Dulce et decorum est. Great Nest has no strict hierarchy. By human standards, in fact, spider society would appear something like functional anarchy. Social standing is everything, and it is won by contribution. Those peer groups whose warriors win battles, whose scholars make discoveries, who have the most elegant dancers, eloquent storytellers, or skilled crafters, these garner invisible status that brings them admirers, gifts, favours, greater swarms of sycophantic males to serve as their workforce, petitioners seeking to add their talents to the group's existing pool. Theirs is a fluid society, where a capable female can manage a remarkable amount of social mobility. Or, in their own minds, their culture is a complex web of connections respun every morning. One key reason this all works is that the middling, unpleasant labour is undertaken by males, who otherwise have no particular right to claim sanctuary within the nest at all if they lack a purpose or a patroness. The hard labour,
forestry, agriculture and the like, is mostly undertaken by the domesticated ant colonies that the Great Nest spiders have manipulated into working with them. After all, the ants work by nature. They have no inclination or capacity to consider the wider philosophy of life, and so such opportunity would be wasted on them. From the point of view of the ant colonies, they prosper as best they can, given the peculiarly artificial environment they find themselves enmeshed in. Their colonies have no real concept of what is pulling their strings, or how their industry has been hijacked to serve Great Nest. It all works seamlessly. Portia's is a society now pulled taut to breaking point. The fact of the encroaching ant column demands sacrifices, and there is no chain of command to determine who must make them and for whose benefit. If the situation becomes much worse, then Great Nest will start fraying apart, fragmenting into smaller fugitive units and leaving only a memory of the high point of spider culture. Alternatively, some great leaders